From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now, here's your host, Mark Kepler.
In January, Governor Brown projected another big surplus over what was projected in last June's state budget package. But the governor's warning that financial clouds may be forming. Should the surplus be saved, spent on new programs, or used to pay down the state's debts? What are the governor's budget priorities? And what do budget reform groups think of the budget process generally, and the governor's budget in particular? We'll ask Mac Taylor, leader of California's Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office, or LAO, the authoritative voice on the state's fiscal matters, and Fred Silva, the senior fiscal policy advisor of California Forward, one of the state's most respected reform groups. The governor's 2016 budget. Sunny today, rain tomorrow.
We'll also hear from California State University political science professor Jeff Cummins.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute. It's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. In January, the governor presented his 2016-17 budget proposal to the legislature. What are the governor's priorities? And will the state have revenues to pay for its short and long-term expenses? Our guest is Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst and the authoritative source for a nonpartisan analysis of the state budget. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thank you, Mark. Nice to be back.
So what's your overall impression of the governor's budget?
Well, first of all, things have been going very well for the state economically. Driven by the Bay Area in particular, the state's economy has been doing very well. State revenues have been doing very well. The governor's budget reflects that. There's lots of new money. And the governor takes a cautious approach. I think he expressed his concern about what happens if the economy heads south and revenues head south in the near future. So what he's done is put a lot of money away in reserves and spent a lot of what he does spend. It's on one-time purposes so that you don't have that spending that would be ongoing.
Ongoing expenses that really cause a problem in the budget.
Can cause a problem, yes.
You know, this is not the first time we've seen an increase in revenue over initial projections. What is driving these new higher revenue projections?
Well, the governor did come up quite a bit. Say, for in this current year that we're in now, the 15-16 fiscal year, he came up over $3 billion from what he had assumed back when the budget was passed last June. Now, this is about the number where we were at last June, so we didn't think much had changed. And in fact, I think the governor just had to recognize that cash was coming in a lot better than what they had estimated, so they increased their numbers.
Yeah, and truth be told, if you take a look at the LAO's reports, typically you're closer to the numbers in the final analysis. It seems like you're a little closer.
Well, I think in recent years that's the case. Not always been the case in the past, but in recent years I think we've done probably a little better job of nailing the capital gains related monies.
I was trying to give you a shout out.
I appreciate it.
Anyway, you know, you've been talking about, you're hearing other people talk about this issue of revenue deterioration, much of it tied to stock market volatility. Can you explain that connection?
Well, we had actually used that term in a blog post that we had just a little while ago, and it was based on the money that came in January. That can be a big month for personal income taxes because high-income taxpayers are making their last estimated payment for 2015. And the money didn't come in quite as well as we had all assumed. And that, coupled with what happened in January in the stock market, that was the reason we sort of put out a caution that, hey, at least we're now seeing some signs, not that things might be better once we get to May and June and closing out the budget, they could be a little bit worse.
You know, are there other economic conditions other than just, say, stock prices that could change the state's revenue forecasts yet again?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, we're closely tied with the national economy, so should that slow down more than we had predicted, that would affect our revenues. Obviously, events in China and Asia, we've built in what's happening there, but if it were worse than what we had estimated, revenues could go down. If the market were to take another correction downward, all of those things could affect our revenues, especially when you look forward, you know, almost 18 months of what happens before the end of the year.
Yeah, projections, that can't be easy. You're trying to You know, the further you go out, the more difficult it is.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, we feel somewhat confident in making projections, say, for the coming budget year. Beyond that is a little bit of a crapshoot.
It's like the family budget. I can deal with it for this year, but maybe not 2 or 3 years down the line. You know, the governor's putting a lot of emphasis on reserves. So what is he doing to increase the state's reserves?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. First of all, when people passed Proposition 2 a couple of years ago,
which is the rainy day fund.
The rainy day fund, it requires certain amounts of money. So based on Proposition 2, the reserves would grow by about just over $2.5 billion. What the governor then did is, in addition to that amount, he puts in over $3 billion more into various state reserves.
More than double.
More than double of just what is required in the coming year.
Right.
And that results in a total reserves of about 9%, which is the highest that I can remember, 9% of our general fund revenue.
I think a lot of companies would like to have a 9 or 10% reserve. That sounds pretty good.
Well, I think in general you'd say that sounds good. Just have to remember that our revenue structure in this state is very volatile.
That's true.
It can go up and down rather quickly. So 9% might think, it seems like a lot, but we can lose that very quickly.
You know, it's interesting you make that point, because a number of years ago when we spoke, you said that you were projecting $20 billion deficits as far as the eye could see. The total amount here is going to be about, what, $10 billion in reserve?
Yes, exactly.
So that would get you 6 months in a downturn.
Now, again, back then, we were talking about the effects of the Great Recession, which
right.
was rather extreme. So a 9 or 10% reserve could go a long ways towards buying you time to help you to adjust to any economic slowdown.
That kind of begs the question, what is the appropriate number for a reserve? Should it be 5%, 10%, more?
Well, there's no right number. What we have told the legislature, pick a robust number. And I realize that's a little bit vague, but I think we were trying to suggest to them, you need a large reserve.
Right.
And whether the governor's, we consider that a fairly robust number, or you want to be even more. The Proposition 2 set a 10% cap or a limit on reserves, and that's certainly a very reasonable level to shoot for, particularly given where we are in terms of the economic recovery. We're towards the tail end, historically
right,
speaking.
Right, right. You know, the governor's been talking a lot about, has in the past, about this wall of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, has he allocated anything in the budget to pay down the state's debt?
Yeah. First of all, I think it's important to distinguish on the wall of debt. The governor, I think, was referring mainly to budgetary-related debt, that is, things we did in the short term to help address the severe budgetary problems we faced in the Great Recession. So it doesn't deal with, like, larger debts of pensions and state retiree health benefits and things like that. But on the budgetary, the wall of debt, as he called it, we've been paying down an awful lot of that. It was probably $35 billion or something like that. And we've paid all but about $9 billion of it. He does commit about $1.5 billion in the coming budget towards sort of working those things down.
It's not glamorous, but it's probably fiscally prudent. I want to ask you about this. We've talked in the past about ballot box budgeting. We have these propositions like Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund, or Prop 98, the Minimum Education Funding Guarantee. What impact does that have on state budgeting?
Well, it certainly limits what the legislature and the governor can do, because these things are somewhat automatic. You know, you have to put this much money in the reserve. You have to spend this much money, at least on schools. It certainly made it more complex, though. Even Proposition 2 and 98, the two items you referenced, they interact in very complicated ways. So it certainly made it, even for my office, and we know a lot about the budget, it's made it much more complex just to understand what's going on in our fiscal matters.
Yeah, it makes it more difficult. Well, up next, a discussion of how the governor plans to pay for some of those bigger expenses, like education infrastructure. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking about the governor's proposed budget with California's nonpartisan budget expert, Mac Taylor, the state's legislative analyst. Let's talk about some of the state's bigger current ongoing expenses. Education's one. It's the largest part of the budget. This is K-12 and community college. About 40% of the general fund expenditures, largely driven by formulas, as we discussed. This year, given the improved budget picture, seems to be a significant increase in school funding. How much? And by the way, are there any strings attached to that money?
Schools do very well. When I say schools, like you say, it's both elementary and high schools and the community colleges, do very well, as they've done for the past 2 or 3 years. They get about $4.3 billion more over not only the budget year, the current year, and the past year, because we have to make these adjustments to Proposition 98 spending. And so that's a large chunk of money. Most of it is ongoing. There is a large chunk, about $1.3 billion, that's one-time in nature. That's given out to schools to spend on whatever sort of one-time things that they want to spend it on. They could do deferred maintenance. They could buy equipment. They could do whatever they want. And the ongoing money is basically strings-free. That is, it's going out under what's called the local control funding formula.
And that funding formula, my understanding is, it's trying to give more money to poor districts. English is a second language, low-income districts?
The formula gives out money sort of equally throughout to districts, but it is based on how many kids you have who are low-income or English learners.
Okay. So there are not really strings attached. So they're given the money, and they could use this on teacher salaries, for example.
Whatever they want. Hire teachers, pay more, whatever they want to do.
Okay. Let's talk about universities, the UC and the CSU. They're getting a 5% increase in the state budget. There's also money to help pay for a $1.1 billion expansion to UC Merced. Essentially, it's going to increase the student population by 75%, up to 10,000 students, and more than double its space by 2020. The governor's premised a lot of this education funding, higher education funding, on no tuition increase. But usually he attaches it to things like metrics, like improved graduation rates or increases in enrollment. Is that happening here, or is this just he's giving them the 5% and do with it what you will?
For the most part, they'll have control over how they spend the monies. There are some exceptions. We do give them, like UC, money for their retirement system that has to go to that. We give them some small amounts for deferred maintenance. They have to spend it on that. But for the most part, they can spend it on whatever they want. Same thing as with schools. They could hire more professors, deal with more enrollment, kind of do with it what the systems desire.
Mm-hmm. And there's actually negotiations ongoing right now with the CSU faculty, and they're asking for an increase in who knows what will happen there.
But I think everyone assumes that some would go for compensation for their employees.
Right. So I guess we'll find out. Since I'm a professor, I've got some interest in that. I will admit that. Well, listen, there's also discussion about the state's infrastructure, you know, maintaining roads and schools and jails and state office buildings, things of that nature. Recently, there was a special session by the legislature specifically talking about the deterioration of state highways. What has the governor proposed in this budget for state highway maintenance needs?
Very similar to a plan that he's had out there for several months. He would increase both registration fees of all car drivers, vehicle drivers, and he would increase the gas tax. He would raise about $3.6 billion in total annually that would go for improving our and maintaining our highways.
Those vehicle fees get people excited. Yeah. My understanding, it's about a $65 vehicle fee increase.
That's right.
So, all right, what about public infrastructure? What's the governor doing there to improve it, like state office buildings and things of that nature?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most of the one-time money is spent on infrastructure. $1.5 billion for some state buildings and about $800 million for deferred maintenance for assets throughout the state of all types. And so that's quite a bit of money.
Well, I noticed in your report where you were talking about county jail construction, $250 mm-hmm. million going there.
That's true, too.
So
that's part of it.
A lot of money and needed because of realignment, obviously. You stated in your review that, quote, the governor's attention to infrastructure makes sense, unquote, but you still want the legislature to consider some other things. What and why?
Well, first of all, if you think about one-time spending, it's not just infrastructure. The legislature might want to use some one-time spending to pay down some of its retirement-related debts, for example.
Which are significant.
Which are very significant and carry high sort of costs and interest-like right. costs associated with them. So first of all, I was just telling him, look, you have other choices between infrastructure and other one-time expenditures. Within infrastructure, you have choices. He's made selections about these three state buildings, for example, that he wants to replace. There's lots of other state buildings we could address. There's lots of other state assets. Think about water or levees or all sorts of things that we could think about. You know, where should we spend that next dollar? So we like his focus on infrastructure. It's just that the legislature has a lot of the choices that it could make.
And they need to look at that. Well, I want to thank Mac Taylor for that discussion on the state budget. Up next, what do government reform groups think of the governor's budget? We'll hear from one of them, one of the more influential groups, Cal Forward, a group focused on the state's fiscal management. That's next on the Matter Report. Welcome back. California Forward is a bipartisan effort to distill the work of public commissions and private think tanks to come up with specific reforms to improve state government. Our guest is Fred Silva. He's California Forward's senior fiscal policy advisor and expert in state and local finance. Welcome to the Matter Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So we were talking about reserves earlier. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how much should the state have in its reserves to prepare for the next economic downturn?
You know, I wish there were a simple answer to that. California Forward, in its early period, did a lot of work looking at best practices of other states. We came to two conclusions. One of those conclusions was those states that have volatile revenue sources, where their revenues move
that
up and down.
Sounds like California.
Yes, with the economy, they tended to have larger reserves. They did better when they had larger reserves. Currently, I think our reserve number's up to about 7% of total revenue.
7 to 9%,
something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty healthy reserve If the objective is to have a reserve to cushion a downturn, I wish there were a magic number that some states have figured out. There's the number, but there isn't.
Yeah. It depends on the magnitude of the downturn, right?
Absolutely.
Because we were going through, we have a $10 billion surplus reserve now proposed, but we had a time not so long ago, we were dealing with $20 billion deficits. So it kind of depends. And that was a very bad recession, of course.
Right. And in that case, it's not that you can get a reserve in order to finance all of an economic downturn, because you can't do that. The objective is to cushion that
downturn. Cushion the blow. So what about using this excess money to retire some of the state's long-term debts, like pensions and retiree health? Yeah.
You know what? One of the benefits of the current reserve system was actually brought to us by the voters with Prop 2.
The Rainy Day Fund.
Exactly. California Forward was very active in that process, thinking we needed a system that captured spikes in revenue, as well as had a continuing deposit that goes into the reserve, for two purposes. One of them was to build a cushion for downturn. The other was to take some of that money, some of which is one time, and use it to pay off long-term debt and long-term liabilities, which is what it does.
What about using this excess money to deal with one-time infrastructure projects? Instead of putting all the money into reserves, let's take care of some of the things we haven't been taking care of.
Right, and Prop 2 allows you to do that. Particularly when the components of Prop 2, one of those components is to capture a portion of the spike in capital gains, that amount of money that you don't normally get, that amount is what's pulled off to the reserve, half of which can be spent on infrastructure and long-term liability.
Yeah, because those capital gains go up and down, obviously, with the stock market.
Exactly.
Right? And that's one of the problems with California's volatile revenue structure that we've heard before. So if we're taking some of this money and using it for one-time infrastructure projects, how should those projects be prioritized?
Well, you know, that's one
of... And not politicized.
Yeah. A good question. There are two parts to that. One of them is where that need exists. It exists to a large extent in our regional economies, either in Southern California, the Inland Empire, the Valley, certainly. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the legislature to appropriate those through a regular public process.
But then politics come in. I mean, one of the issues is, of course, you know, the political power, frankly, is where the population is in Southern California or maybe in the Bay Area. You could make an argument that the needs are in the Valley.
They are indeed a substantial amount of the need. Each of our economic regions has a set of needs. What's important for the legislature is to recognize those needs and to take those resources, again, that are one time in nature, and apply those to those infrastructure needs that are regionally based. So the legislature ought to listen to the Valley and ask them, what are those infrastructure needs? Now, Proposition 1 of some time ago that provided for the transportation bonds, a significant amount of that money went into the improvement of Highway 99. Mm-hmm. So that was an example of the state listening to the regions, in that particular case, the Valley.
I think one of the things you sometimes get worried about is when you take some of these spikes in revenue and then create ongoing programs as opposed to one-time deals, because then the program continues, but the revenue doesn't.
Which you want to avoid.
Right. Yeah. So what's the best way to finance these infrastructure projects? There's lots of ways to do it. You can do a direct appropriation. We could rent or lease the project, or we could borrow through bonds. Yeah. What's the best approach? Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, there are users of infrastructure, particularly in water and resource management kinds of infrastructure, where the user ought to have the obligation to help finance that infrastructure. There are other instances, some of them environmental, where there's not a direct nexus or link between the user and the investment. And for those, you use the general economy to do that through general obligation bonds and through the tax system. So I think you first start with who's the beneficiary here.
And then make a decision from there.
Right.
Okay, what do we do about the state's roller coaster revenue situation? That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Fred Silva from California Forward. He's their senior fiscal policy advisor and expert on state and local finance. You know, we're talking about revenue for the state, and the main source of revenue is personal income taxes. People might be surprised to know that's about two-thirds of the revenue. It's highly volatile. We talked about that with capital gains. So when we see these spikes in revenue, I mean, should we be thinking about new commitments, things we've left off in the past, maybe add to, or should we be resisting that urge and just saying, no, let's just pay off the debts and deal with, you know, one-time infrastructure kind of deals?
I think that what's key here is a sense of fiscal management. And since we are
fiscally prudent.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. But where we're not interested in attacking the tax structure in order to reduce volatility. What's important is to take volatility out of the spending process through the budget.
The other side of the equation.
Exactly. We learned in the probably the post-World War II period all the way up into the 90s that that the model for budgeting was you get what you got in the prior year plus growth. So every nickel, whether it's one time or not, was invested into the program structure. Now, under this domain and this governor, frankly, and legislature, the issue has been what ought we to invest in programs where the economy is growing sufficiently so that it can maintain that investment? And if you've got one-time revenue, that's where that revenue should be invested into infrastructure and paying down liabilities. Prop 2, but we're back to the rainy day fund again, was structured in order to facilitate that.
So I'm going to let you be the governor, okay? So we've got, let's say we've got these ongoing needs. We know we'd have those. And there's the money there and a willingness to pay for it. Which ongoing needs do you think have the highest priority?
Well, historically, it's been education. It's been investment in human capital. And one of the priorities of California Forward has been to kind of figure out how we should invest better in human capital. That's from K to 12 through higher education.
Well, let's just do K to 12 and community college. I mean, that's over 40% of the state budget
It is. It's about 55% if you include higher ed in it.
Okay, and higher ed, that's another bump, right?
And frankly, it has been that way for a very long time. The voters put a constitutional guarantee
Prop 98.
Yeah, that Prop 98 in 1988. And if you look back before that, we were still spending about that amount. There were times during the Duke Majent administration when there was tension.
What did Prop 98 do? It just continued what we were already doing?
Well, what it did was it set up a minimum allocation that if the legislature or governor tried to deal with it, they'd have to suspend it and it would take an action of the legislature to reduce the guarantee.
Sounds like a little distrust there of the politicians.
Absolutely. And that's where the education world comes in and says, we want to force you to, if you need to reduce the guarantee, you need to vote to do that.
Right.
And that's
right.
One of the objectives of Prop 98.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Prop 98 with the minimum guarantee for education. Mm-hmm. You've got Prop 2, the rainy day fund, all these ballot box budgeting things that voters seem to pass. Good idea, bad idea?
You know, we have basic rules that we put in the Constitution. And one of them is our budgeting practice, which went in the Constitution in 1922. We've been doing ballot box budgeting since the 1920s. So I'm not as bothered about ballot box budgeting. The problem with it is that it's so easy to capture resources and to apply them to something. So you take the cigarette, let's raise the cigarette tax and put it over here. Let's raise another tax and put it over there. That's the dilemma in ballot box budgeting. What Prop 98 did was Prop 98 basically said, state, you have a minimum funding level that we want to see in education. So figure out how to do that.
Okay, well, you know, talking about that, you know, we had Prop 30 recently to provide a little more funding for education. That's being phased out. What's going to happen if that goes away? And there's supposed to be a temporary tax. Yeah. What happens in the post-Prop 30 world in terms of education funding?
Well, what's interesting about this, if you look at the way Prop 30 was constructed, and then arguably the way Prop 2 is constructed, that there's a phase out that's done of Prop 30. And as it phases out, the administration's forecast, as well as the legislative analyst's forecast, argues that that fiscal management will cover the difference. Now, whether we get to 2019 and 2020 and the economy is still growing, then they can manage their way through it. If the economy isn't growing, then you've got a case where you need to come in with reserves through Prop 2 to try to manage your way through it.
You know, we've only got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you kind of a big question,
sure.
And that is, you know, everybody says that our fiscal structure is kind of, it's volatile. We've talked about that. What would you say is politically viable? What steps could we do to kind of lessen that volatility?
There are two of them. One of them, I think, has been done in Prop 2, which, again, took the volatility out of the spending
side.
And the other is to watch the way in which programs that are themselves volatile, because their caseloads grow, is to manage those in a way that produces results, that focuses on results as opposed to simply the swings of putting money in one year and taking it out
another. Well, there's your solution. I want to thank Fred Silva, California Forward's Senior Policy Analyst, as well as Mac Taylor, the California Legislative Analyst, for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org and sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in The Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or The Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, what impact will the state's improving finances have on the Valley? We'll talk to Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins.
You're listening to The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. So what does the governor's budget mean for the San Joaquin Valley? We're going to talk to California State University political science professor Jeff Cummins. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
Okay, well, listen, how would you characterize Governor Brown's 2016 budget?
Well, I think there are a number of metaphors that could apply here. Probably the one that captures them all is more of the same. He's always been real fiscally cautious and conservative. He's spent a lot of time trying to educate the media and the public that while we might be reaping the rewards of a strong economy right now, eventually we're going to have a downturn. So I would you know, overall characterize it as just being prudent. He's putting a lot of the money away in a reserve fund, which is what you need for that inevitable economic downturn.
Yeah, it's interesting. You used to work with the Legislative Analyst Office, and you're using the same – they must teach you guys the same terminology, because that's what the LAO said. He said it was generally prudent. And they were talking about, which I think you're implying here, the vulnerability remains because a downturn is frankly inevitable at some point. And so the governor's trying to be relatively conservative in terms of building up the reserves. I guess, you know, we were talking about it in the earlier segment. He's building those reserves bigger than what is legally mandated. He's adding more money to those. Isn't he?
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea, because I think if you just follow the requirements of the reserve fund, it's not going to nearly be enough for what will eventually be a pretty huge swing in revenue, and we can talk more about why that swing in revenue is going to be so large eventually.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of concern I think out there that this may just be good for now, but who knows what's going to happen down the line. Let me ask you this. You know, you published a book called Boom or Bust, The Politics of the California Budget. So a little shout out there for your book. People can find it, I guess, on Amazon. Do you agree with the notion that the state could experience revenue deterioration in the future because of the overemphasis on the personal income tax?
Yeah, and I would, you know, go even further than to say deterioration, because that kind of implies that it's a slow deterioration. And what we know from the past...
Are you talking about a fiscal cliff?
Slow. Yeah, we're talking about fiscal cliff, I think, is a more accurate depiction. And this is what has happened going back to the 1980s. And this is what I try and cover in the book, is to describe what has gone on over the last several decades that was different prior to the 1980s. And a big part of that that fiscal cliff is that reliance on personal income taxes that you mentioned. We're now nearly, in terms of our general fund, the state's main bank account, about 70% of that general fund revenue comes from the personal income tax. And that's the highest it's been in state history.
Wow.
And the problem with that is personal income tax is the most volatile source of revenue. So that's why we get these really strong swings in one direction or another. It's because so much of it is coming from that personal income tax.
So capital gains on the market, you have stuff invested in the market, and the price fluctuates, and that impacts what the state's getting
exactly
in terms of revenue. And I read somewhere that the top 1% pay about half of the state's income taxes. So it's really so it's a real focus then on the higher income people and on their personal income tax. So I remember a few years ago we were talking about the dot-com recession about 10 years or so ago, and they were saying that – I was reading that tax revenues dropped by 50% because of just that one situation that was going on in the stock market. So it's a kind of – it illustrates just how incredibly sensitive California's revenues are to what's happening in the stock market. And, you know, something could be happening in China. The market could take a – could tank. Oil prices go down. The stock market doesn't do well. That impacts what we're doing here. So that kind of leads me to the next question. That is, you know, the governor's proposing adding this additional $2 billion over and above the required allocation for the state's rainy day fund. So that's a total reserve of $10.2 billion by the end of fiscal year 16-17. You know, of course, you know, any money saved means that money's not being spent on improving schools, roads, social services, things of that nature. Is that good for the Valley? I mean, how is, you know, it's good for the state's financial stability, but those kinds of projects, roads, schools, those kinds of things, aren't they kind of important for the Valley too?
No, I mean, I think it's definitely a hard decision over what to do when you have these surges in revenue. And really, there are two scenarios. So, you know, we talked about how would you characterize Governor Brown's budget. You know, it's cautious. He's stocking the money away in a savings account. He's devoting a big chunk of it to infrastructure projects, which are temporary in nature. So there's two different things you can do when you get these surges. One is you can devote it to ongoing programs where you're spending it on education and healthcare programs. And, you know, these are some of the programs we often think of as entitlements, where this is permanent spending that's going to last, you know, much longer than 5 to 10 years. So you can spend these surges on that type of spending, or you can devote it to more temporary types of projects and, you know, sock it away in a savings account. And Governor Brown has chosen to do the latter. So certainly if we did the first, where we increase spending on those different education and social programs, the Valley would benefit from that. But then the question arises, what happens when we get this swing in revenue and you have to pull the carpet out from those programs?
Well, what if you talk about this? What about instead of spending that extra, you know, $2 billion, allocating that to the state's rainy day fund, taking that $2 billion and fixing 99, for example? And that would be a kind of a one-time infrastructure improvement. I guess the question is that a better use of that $2 billion, or is it better to sock that money away for the inevitable downturn that we're going to have? I mean, there's good arguments on either side of that.
Yeah, sure. I don't think there's any scientific way to get at that, and it comes down to your perspective. You devote that money to the reserves, and in a couple of years, you don't have to cut back on those social programs as much when that recession hits.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of whether or not you think that's more beneficial than making sure that 99 doesn't have a bunch of potholes on it.
Right. You know, I don't know if you I'm sure you've probably been paying attention to this MCO tax that they've negotiated at the state legislature. That's for managed care organizations, and it's incredibly complicated to follow just how that pay structure goes. But the bottom line is it's going to add another $1 billion to the state coffers, essentially. So that's probably good news in terms of there's even more money now that we can either save or spend on infrastructure projects.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, that they were expecting that to be a $1 billion hole. That's money that goes towards the Medi-Cal program, which provides health insurance for low-income families. So that definitely benefits Valley households here as well.
Yeah, and so it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what the governor and the legislature do with that extra $1 billion. I mean, are they going to save it? Are they going to spend it on something? That'll be interesting to watch. You know, staying with this whole idea of, I guess, rainy day, I'm going to stay with the water theme here, and let's talk about the current budget as it relates to water. What are your thoughts on the governor's drought response and in this budget?
Well, I think he's trying to prioritize the most immediate needs right? Those communities that lack any sort of safe drinking water, and the communities that have been most devastated by the drought. And that's a lot of communities here in the valley, some of the outlying communities. So he's allocating some of the bond proceeds that we adopted a few years ago, and they're trying to do studies of some of the more long-term projects like building dams and so on. So, it's hard to say if it's enough. I haven't seen any assessment of the needs in a lot of these communities, if it's going to do enough to satisfy their water needs or not.
Now, it seems like that the governor is really focusing in this budget on continuing the emergency response, but not really funding any new funding for long-term water supply projects. I think the argument is those long-term water supply projects are long-term. They're not going to address the problem immediately. And so the money is going to the immediate needs. And the question is, when do we start planning for the future? And so the question is, should the governor be spending more money? And just do you think there's going to be more pressure now with – is it going to be a weather-related situation as opposed to a political situation? If the El Nino is strong, particularly strong this year, less of a push to allocate more money for drought response, and if it's a weak El Nino, more pressure?
Yeah, I think it certainly relieves some pressure from the public to do some of these long-term projects. We kind of think that when we get a lot of rainfall that that the drought is over, and people are mistaken in that. You could see that, just in terms of assessing kind of the reaction to the El Nino rains, and that the benchmarks that communities were supposed to hit for water conservation, more of the jurisdictions did not meet those targets when the rain started hitting. Mm-hmm. So that, kind of shows that they're not taking it as seriously, and the governor doesn't have any intention of lifting those conservation benchmarks anytime soon. I think he extended them through October of this year at the very least.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting that the LAO was talking about when they looked at the governor's response to the budget is this $90 million from cap and trade that they're using to deal with the drought response. And the cap and trade program is supposed to be about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It seems like that, they use those funds for lots of different things sometimes.
Yeah, they're a nice little pot of money that the legislature and governor like to squabble over every year. If we can kind of capture the whole budget situation over the last, well, at least during Governor Brown's administration, once they dug themselves out of the deficit, it's really been about the legislature wanting to spend more money on these ongoing programs, and the governor trying to hold back the legislature from doing that.
Yeah. Well, up next, we're going to discuss some of the biggest ticket items in the state budget, education and transportation. That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report.
You're listening to the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking about the governor's proposed budget for 2016 and what it may mean to the Valley with Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins. So, Jeff, we talked earlier about K-12 and community college education in the first segment of the show, that how big that is in terms of the state budget. It's over 40% of the general fund expenditures. And while California's per pupil spending still lags other states, spending has increased rather dramatically over the last 5 years. But a good chunk of that is going to the kind of high priority areas, I guess you'd call them, school districts with low income or English as a second language students. And they're using this thing called a local control funding formula that districts can decide how to allocate that money. Money used to be given by the state in something called categoricals. They would literally, here's the money and here's what you can use it for. That's no longer the situation. Now it's, here's the money, do whatever you can. In fact, we'll give you some additional funding if you have a high proportion of low income and ESL students. And by the way, that describes a lot of Valley schools, that demographic. So here's the question. With all this money going to close the achievement gap, what does that mean for the Valley? Is that going to help us begin to create a more educated workforce so the Valley can compete economically?
Well, yeah, I would say that the new formula definitely benefits the Valley overall, but I don't think we can think of it as an immediate cure for the Valley's educational problems, because our problems go much deeper than, you know, just giving more money, allocating more money to the situation. You know, there's lots of research. We hear about this more often, about how important those initial, you know, roughly 3 to about 8 years of a child's life is, where that achievement gap starts to emerge and then grow over time. And so, you know, the more money we devote to those early years, which Proposition 98 doesn't even cover, you know, the initial roughly 0 to 4 years, because that's before students get in preschool. And once they get in preschool, that's when the state money's starting to kick in. Right, so it's not addressing where that achievement gap emerges in those early years.
Do you think the funding should be focused on, like, on pre-K?
I think, yeah, certainly more of it could be devoted to pre-K. You know, the achievement gap gets measured later on in school years. Mainly, there's a lot of focus on grades 3 through 8, for instance. And you know, there are some researchers out there that say by the time that you get to grade 3, that those gaps have already become pretty permanent.
Yeah, I've read similar research that says that you, by like the 3rd or 4th grade, you can already tell who's going to graduate, who's going to drop out. So those things are already kind of set at that point. But the other one of the kind of the implications here, the assumptions, is that more money is going to result in better results. I mean, kind of a question here is, if you, frankly, invest more money, or some people would say throw more money at the problem of education, does that necessarily mean that we're going to have a more educated workforce? Is there a correlation there?
The shorter answer is no. I think there's a misperception that the more money spent, the better the education system. And there's lots of research out there that says that that's not true. It really depends on how you spend it. It depends on the parental involvement and the home environment of children. So schools can kind of do all they want during the school day, but those kids are still going home to an environment that is not supportive of education.
Right.
Now, having said that, you want to spend the money where it's going to be most effective, and we know that one of the areas where it's going to be most effective is on teacher effectiveness. That comes up over and over again in these studies, that where we see pretty significant improvements in student performance is when you have experienced, well-paid teachers.
You know, that's an interesting point that's an interesting point about well-paid teachers. I mean, the question that some people have is, should this local control funding formula money be used, quote unquote, in the classroom, or, quote unquote, given to teachers? Like, there's a difference between the two. But some people argue that the money shouldn't be spent on increasing salaries. Other people say that kind of the point I think you're making, and that is having the best possible person in front of that classroom is really critical, and you have to, frankly, pay for that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm one of those that supports that idea that you need to have well-paid instructors. And one of the problems in the school districts that suffer the most is they tend to have the most inexperienced teachers and the highest rates of turnover. And a lot of the times these are teachers that have emergency credentials. So if you can, you know, totally flip around those percentages, I think we would go a long way towards improving the student performance in some of the low-performing schools.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think I read that teacher salaries, while they're relatively high in California, the class sizes are very large in California. The other thing is, while they've seen about a 10.6% increase in teacher salaries over the last few years, that's actually behind the rate of inflation. So yes, they're getting an increase, but they're not keeping up with the rate of inflation for teachers. Let's transition to higher education.
Sure.
Let's talk about University of California and CSU. They got a nice little bump, 5% increase in the state's in the governor's budget. Some of that money, though, is going to be specifically targeted to UC Merced for a $1.1 billion expansion. That's going to result in a 75% increase in the student body from about 10,000 students from where they are now to about 10,000 students, more than doubling, and also more than doubling their space size by 2020. I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, they're really ramping up UC Merced. What does that mean for the Valley?
Well, I think it's definitely a positive for the Valley because these universities try and target students that are coming from Valley High School. So the more capacity they have, I think it's definitely better for the Valley educational community. Fresno State is, you know, I don't want to say we're maxed out, but we're getting pretty close to maxed out infrastructure-wise. So having an expanded UC Merced will help to accommodate that growing enrollment. And if you look at both the UC and the CSU system, there's huge demand to get into these schools, and both systems have to turn away tens of thousands of students each year. So if we're going to try and meet that college education gap in the future, we're going to need to expand the capacity of our university system.
You know, it's interesting. One of the caveats to this funding is no tuition increases at UC or CSU. Now, I think for most parents, that probably sounds pretty good. The problem is, or the question is, what happens if you freeze tuition over time? Aren't you then just asking for a huge increase at some other time because that pressure starts to build for more resources? Or does that put pressure on higher education to be more efficient, more online classes, things of that nature?
Yeah, that whole problem gets back to what the central problem of our overall state budget is with the volatility. We know eventually the revenue is going to turn in the other direction. And when that happens, the university systems have no choice but to try and make up that loss of revenue with huge tuition increases. And so right now, I think both systems are considering whether or not to start tying the tuition to inflation so that you would have more incremental adjustments each year so that you wouldn't have those huge increases in tuition. And I would probably favor that. I think, you know, it's having a budget that's more predictable, at least from the standpoint of families who are having to fund their children's education, that if they can plan on those increases, it makes it a little better than if they just have to deal with these huge, you know, 10-15% increases in tuition in 1 year.
Yeah, I think also the governor has been talking about, you know, increasing graduation rates, and there's been discussion about the need for qualified college graduates in the next 10 years, and they're talking about over a million-person shortfall. And so need to kind of get people through the system. There's a lot of students, you know, back in the day when I was in college, I don't want to say how long ago that was, but most students graduated in 4 years. That is really an anomaly today. Most students are taking 6 years or longer to graduate. So if they can kind of somehow figure a way to make graduation and get the classes you need to graduate more quickly, that would really help in terms of lowering cost of education and getting those graduates that we need. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out with the UC. But you're going to see a big jump at UC Merced, a big expansion going on there. So let me ask you another question, kind of infrastructure-related question, and that deals with transportation. The governor is proposing $3.6 billion for transportation. As you know, there was a special session last fall. I think it's still continuing on transportation. They haven't really resolved that funding issue yet. I've seen different numbers, anywhere from $57 to $59 billion in maintenance needs for the state. I just want to get your thoughts on the governor's $3.6 billion transportation proposal to start addressing some of those transportation maintenance needs.
Yeah, it's absolutely necessary that we try and repair our infrastructure. When some of the organizations that grade road conditions, California usually gets a D in those grading systems. So everybody agrees that we definitely need to repair and build capacity in our highway and road system. But in terms of the solution for that, as you mentioned, the governor and legislature have been negotiating, considering a way to fund this because of the decline in the gas tax revenue that helps to fund road and highway infrastructure. So the governor has proposed a $65 increase in vehicle registration fees. And
what do you think? Can I just stop you right there? What do you think of the politics of that? I mean, didn't that get one governor into a lot of trouble with that vehicle registration fee? I mean, is that politically palatable?
It's definitely a hard sell. I would say that that's what one of the reasons that Gray Davis got into trouble back in the early 2000s and contributed to his recall.
And by the way, my understanding is $2 billion of that $3.6 billion the governor is going to put toward transportation comes from that $65 vehicle registration tax. So it's a good chunk.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And if we can, you know, just compare the tax proposals with the MCO tax that we talked about earlier, the managed care organization tax, that sailed through with, you know, pretty relatively strong Republican support, but it doesn't look like the Republicans are going to be on board with some of these car tax increases.
Well, one of the arguments that they're making is that, you know, the LAO came out with a report a while ago that Caltrans bureaucracy was bloated, and I want to say over several hundred million dollars of inefficiencies. And one of the things the governor is putting in this $3.6 billion package is he's saying he's going to get $100 million worth of efficiencies out of Caltrans. So I think probably one of the issues between Republicans and Democrats might be how much can we increase efficiencies at Caltrans so we don't have to increase taxes? I mean, that's going to be a big issue, I would assume.
Yeah, no, I agree. Caltrans has always been notorious for inefficiencies in their project delivery. So I think you can, you know, get some additional funding out of that. But it's not going to be anywhere near what we need to repair our infrastructure. And if, you know, the Republicans are concerned about that, then they can turn the state auditor on to Caltrans and try and work out some of these efficiencies so that there are more efficient operations.
I think you might have just given some people some ideas. Well, I want to thank Jeff Cummins, political science professor at California State University of Fresno, for joining us. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you, Mark.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.